Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the trade war. And Richard, the day before we're recording this, we got news that the Trump administration is going to be spending $12 billion in emergency aid to come to the help of American farmers in the wake of the disruption to their business emerging from the president's quite aggressive use of tariffs and the reciprocal measures that other countries have taken in response. China, for instance, has put tariffs of $34 billion worth of American goods. That includes farm products like soybeans and pork. And we've seen similar moves from Mexico and Canada and the EU, which we'll discuss in a moment. But Richard, all of our listeners probably know by this point that you think the tariffs are a bad and economically counterproductive idea. So let me start you off with sort of the more prudential question here. Unambiguous, really, at this point, that farmers are feeling at least short-term pain from this. Even the White House concedes that. They argue, of course, that it's for long-term gain. But how does a free market guy like yourself think about this particular question? I know you're generally no friend of subsidies, but you have a situation here where people are taking a hit because of government policy. If the tariffs are going to be there, better to provide this assistance even at the cost of sacrificing more free market principles, or just to hold fast and not compound the error?
Well, I don't want to compound the error because it might increase the period at which you keep the tariffs in place. But let's put it this way. The president says this stuff is painless. If it's painless, you don't have to give subsidies. If you do give subsidies, A, it's not painless, and B, the pain is now going to be on everybody. First of all, the president picks a number out of the hat. We have no idea whether the loss to farmers will be $2 billion, $10 billion, or $100 billion. To my mind, given the size of the American export trade, the $12 billion should be understood as a down payment on a much larger sum of money with much greater distortion, and that nobody should think that it solves the problem. So what do? You still have farmers who are hurting. Some of them are going to get this aid. Some of them are not going to get this aid. There's going to be a bureaucracy which will chew up a large part of this money. And then the taxes have to come from somebody else. There are no such things as free lunches. If you don't raise taxes, then you have to expand the money supply. If you don't do that, then you have to borrow. But sooner or later, somebody's going to have to pay the piper. And then you have to explain why it is that you want this trade war to be put on everybody instead of on only one person. And I don't think the president can say that. Next, of course, we have automobiles, and if this actually comes to pass, I certainly hope it does not, we're going to have to bail out the automakers, and of course, the best way to do that is to tax the farmers. And so after a while, what happens is all you do is you make the negative sum larger and larger by the efforts to have this sort of ad hoc, imprecise redistribution from the president. It proves quite conclusively that it's not easy to win a trade war. Quite the opposite. Nobody wins a trade war. Or as one of the EU people said, if you can be stupid, we can be stupid. And that's exactly what's happened. Mutual stupidity means that we lose. It means that the Europeans lose to the extent that this deal stays in place. It means that the Chinese lose. It may not be a world depression. I think in the United States, what's essentially going to happen is this will slow down the economy by perhaps as much as 1 point of GDP. It will cost trillions of dollars in one sense or another by the time the thing runs its course over multiple years, unless you bring an end to it. So I think that the president, unless he is such a profound deal maker, can pull rabbits out of hat. If he thinks that this is a serious substantive proposal, then the ignorance that he has with respect to trade is just simply carried over to the ignorance he has with respect to taxes. You cannot get rid of one error by creating another error. They only compound and accumulate. They never cancel out.
So let's play out the profound dealmaker hypothetical, because just a few hours before we tape this, the president had a press conference in the Rose Garden with the president of the European Commission, where he announced that they are working towards a deal, the features of which, and I quote, would be zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies on non-auto industrial goods, close quote. So, Richard, this has been the argument that a lot of the president's defenders who are not themselves protectionists have been using for a while. The president is using the tariffs as a tool because it's the only stick he has here, with the ultimate goal of actually getting freer and fairer trade. Now, this deal with Europe, we should stipulate, is totally aspirational as of this taping. All we have to go on is this press conference.
Yes.
But does the fact that there may be some signs of progress here change at all how you view what the president has done on trade thus far?
It makes me hopeful that somebody has talked him off of the ledge. And the point that you just made, of course, exempts oil automobiles from this. And that shows, I think, a real retrograde view, because every single domestic and foreign producer understands that the supply chains that are used to create automobiles have no respect for natural boundaries. So domestic companies and foreign companies alike will be hurt. This is a case in which what happens is, to quote Milton Friedman, this wonderful story, there's a hole in the front of the boat and the boat is sinking. So how do you stop the problem? Well, you level the boat out by putting a hole in the back of the boat. And yes, it does create a fair level playing field, but that means you both sink more rapidly. What you have to do is to go for the tariff stuff. You don't have to exempt automobiles. Everything should be in on this particular deal. And the gains that will be taking place are enormous. One of the things that free trade does is indirectly to encourage deregulation in places even like the EU, where it is rampant out of Brussels. Because if you get foreign goods coming in, they speak loud and clear. And if you can't keep them out, which is what you'd like to do in some sense, then you better reform your own shop so as to make sure that you become more competitive. That's exactly what Trump tended to do in the United States. And sure enough, what happens is all of a sudden wages are starting to move up. People are getting off the unemployment rolls in the way in which people never thought possible. The stock market continues to go up. The sort of gloom and doom of the Obama administration that, 1% growth is here to stay. The Keynesians arguing in structural regulation are going to necessarily put us in this position. It's all silly. The same position applies now that applied in 1777 or 1776 when Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations. If you have barriers, people are going to do dumb things. If you get rid of the barriers, private enterprise will flourish. Let me give one story. I think it's the best story I've heard about free trade. I've had a lot of involvement with New Zealand between about 1990 and about 2005. And in 1986, this country was about as dead as any country could be. And then a man named Sir Roger Douglas, who at that time was a member of the Labour Party, decides, I have the following rules that I'm going to put into place. There are going to be no subsidies and there are going to be no tariffs. Not going to do anything else. And you could watch New Zealand start to rise from the dead by that single maneuver. Now, what's the concrete illustration of how it goes? Well, New Zealand farmers used to get tremendous subsidies. So everything they grew was grown to the subsidy. So if four crops get subsidy, the farmers make four crops. The moment you get rid of the subsidies, what's happened is now all of a sudden, instead of making four crops, they make 400 crops or more. That is, if you don't have these subsidies in there, people will now, instead of trying to imitate the other guy to get the subsidy, will try to put some distance between themselves and the other guy by creating a crop that nobody else makes. And when everybody's doing this, it turns out that the array of crops that you sell, the volume of business that you're going to generate in a world market, are far greater. And so understanding all of that, you really want to push very much for the sort of 19th century free trade style, and you never want to let a Keynesian into your house to darken the windows with respect to this. You don't want any protectionists coming in there. You don't want guys who are saying, I'm going to take a short-term hit for a long-term gain. What you want to do is just open up the thread gates, and if you do that, even if the other guys don't do it, you're still better off than they are. Because you will now get inputs that you can use to sell to third markets. Free trade is such a dominant solution that the fact that the president believes not is a lasting blot on his reputation. I can't believe that anybody could be so uninformed on this issue and so persistent. And let's just hope that he's now going to declare victory, because what he's done is he said, well, they're going to buy a little bit more of our natural gas. Well, hell, they would have done that anyhow, I think is the case. Anybody in Europe who wants to buy gas from Putin has to be nuts because of the political risk that's associated if he decides to cut them off. And if the United States simply opens up the gaskets and let all this stuff flow, it's important to make sure that these pipelines are all completed, because otherwise, instead of being able to sell in ways that undercut the Russians, you're going to see what's happened in Boston, where you have to have a Russian tanker loaded with natural gas because of the ways in which the Northeast governors have frustrated all the pipelines that are needed to bring things to major hubs like New York City and Boston.
The president claimed in a tweet this week that the U.S. lost, I'm quoting him here, $817 billion on trade last year. Now, best I can tell, that is a reference to the $811 billion trade deficit, which we ran on goods, doesn't include services. But for our listeners who are not experts in international trade, can you explain in sort of basic terms why the way the president thinks about trade deficits is different than the way that most economists think about trade deficits?
Yes. Well, what the president seems to think is that there's one huge transactions in which what happens is the United States pays $811 billion more for what it gets than it gives. And so if you were to buy a building and you were to pay $2 billion and it was only worth $1,200,000,000, you lose that amount of money. So he kind of aggregates everything together. No trade economist does that. What you do is you break it down into three separate components. First of all, there are all the stuff that we import. And what happens is we pay for this. But given the standard economic principles in both domestic and international trade, you buy something which is worth more to you than it costs. So that all of these transactions are positive sum for us. And on the other side, the guys who are selling it basically only sell things when they prefer the price to the goods. So it's positive sum on the other side. So in the good business school talk, these are win-win transactions. When you start talking about the stuff that not that we buy, but we sell, it's exactly the same story. All those transactions are win-win transactions. So if you're talking about an $800 billion trade deficit and you've got yourself, say, $10 billion in good traded, those $10 billion trades, they have huge positive subsidies, it's benefits. So what happens to the other money? Well, it doesn't disappear. What happens is now they have this extra money, and if they have confidence in the United States, what they do is they invest it in American businesses. So if a country like France has a trade surplus with the United States, Michelin Tires may take some of that money and build another plant in South Carolina, which will hire American workers. So that cash isn't a loss, it's an investment. And what Trump does is he has this lump sum view of the world, which is so erroneous that it's almost painful to have to speak about it. Deficits essentially really don't matter. Obviously, they net out across the entire system. But if you're thinking about it, you want to be a nation which is a debtor nation or a creditor nation. Well, in one case, you're investing somewhere else. In some cases, they're investing in you. It's very difficult in the abstract to see who's better or worse from this thing. So what you just do is you let the machine run just the way you let the machine run when it turns out that there's a trade imbalance between New York and Texas. You don't care which way it runs, but if Trump were right, then all the folks in Texas, if it turns out the trade deficit runs in their direction, should be screaming at New York. We don't do that in the domestic market, and the basic theory of international trade is simple and powerful. You want any transactions that takes place on an international platform to act as though it's a seamless platform which takes place as if all the elements in the trade were in a single domestic economy. That's what the non-discrimination rules were about. That's what the WTO, the World Trade Organization, is about. The system has worked tremendously well for many, many years. There are surely problems with China when it steals intellectual property. But, the folks who put the WTO together, they thought about that as well. And the president, to the extent that he goes off on these tangents, just creates immense uncertainty. And all we can say is that we hope that this deal sticks and it gets expanded, that we do the same thing with respect to NAFTA, that what we try to do is to open up the China trade and push extremely hard on the intellectual property theft, and that we can find the national security exemption to things that involve national security, not to aluminum rolls and not to automobiles, sedans, and things like that. The president's abuse of Section 232 of the code, I think it is, on trade is just a complete travesty. So there's no kudos for the president. He's managed to get on the off ramp. We are not now heading downstream. The announcement must have taken place just before the stock market closed, because if you look at the market, it goes up 175 points in about 15 minutes. And in fact, if there is a stable free trade consensus that covers all American relative theories, the Dow will hit 30,000 very quickly.
You have a number of conservatives, including some of the president's Republican critics in the Senate, like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, who have argued that Congress needs to rein the president in and take away some of the trade authority that they've delegated to him. Give us a sense of how much power they can take back and whether you think that'd be an appropriate course of action.
Well, the answer is they could pretty much take it all back because the president in this particular situation works on delegated authorities. The reason that people are giving the president delegated authority is that if he has to go back to the Congress through a treaty or through legislation in order to get approval, that means that he cannot deal with authority everywhere else. So the compromise that we put together, at least in most areas, the president can make the deal and then it's up or down. That's what happened with respect to TPP. That's probably a sensible strategy, and these deals are tremendously difficult to negotiate. And the moment you start allowing tinkering by one person or another, it will unravel with respect to everybody. So I'm in favor of strong presidential power there. I am not in favor of strong presidential power to allow him to ram anything into the national security exception. I think I know most of what it covers. If you want to sell sensitive aeronautics to Saudi Arabia and you're afraid they're going to get into the hands of Iraq, you can certainly limit that, control it, prevent it, and so forth. I recall one time I went to Stanford as a kind of an interloper. This was a non-security conference, and I listened to all these experts on this field talk about just how complicated it is to run a national security system when you're actually concerned with national security. You cannot avoid that. It's a very big part of the trade regulation system, but you certainly don't want to do it with respect to fungible goods like aluminum rolls and stuff of the sort. And I think Congress there should try to rein in this particular president. There is a further complication. Trump is at president for at most 6.5 more years. You've got to figure out stable relationships for other presidents who may not have these proclivities. You rein in Trump, it could turn out that his successor in office as soon as 2021 could now be at a huge disadvantage in dealing with original international deals. The best thing for the president to do is to put aside his freelancing and to pull more rabbits out of more hats and to quiet the waters on this particular subject matter. There is nothing that he can do. The things that he wants to do, you buy more of this or that good of us, the way in which he's going to paper up his defeat on this thing, which thank God he loses, is to get Europeans to agree to buy larger quantities of stuff when they would have bought larger quantities of stuff anyhow. Natural gas is a perfect illustration. The more we export, the less powerful the Russians are, the better off it is for geopolitical purposes. I think even Germany has to understand that, although Lord knows when it comes to energy policy, you don't want to put your money on Angela Merkel with everything that she's done wrong. But I think on balance, these issues will eventually prevail. Juncker did a very good job. It's much more difficult, and in fact, the bigger problem with the EU is whether they can negotiate a sensible Brexit exit. And right now, it looks as though everybody seems to be floundering. Juncker, I don't think, has done as constructive a job there as elsewhere. I don't think much of Ms. Merkel. I don't think much of Ms. May. It seems to me that this process has gone way out of control, and that certainly we should try to get that thing stabilized, because if you have an unstable European Union over the Brexit exit, it's going to have all sorts of negative ramifications for the rest of the trade system.
The last question that I'll put to you, Richard, the line that we've heard from a lot of the president's critics on trade, and the one that you hinted at earlier, is that he's lucky that he's got the offsetting effects of tax reform and deregulation to prop up the economy. What would it take, in your judgment, to hit an inflection point there where the losses from the trade policy start to outweigh the gains on the tax and regulation side?
Lord, nobody knows the answer. We have looked at this with respect to the Smoot-Hawley tariff and so forth, and still nobody is exactly sure of exactly how much harm it did. Everybody agrees that it did some, but that was at a time when there was less international trade than there is today. But my view about this is if it turns out that what we do is essentially have uniform trade barriers with all exports and all imports, we are past the inflection point, and we will then start to see serious declines in the GDP. Or in the alternative, some desperate measures to unlock the situation. All of the people who talk about trade in a serious fashion always talk about, are there off-ramps? And what they mean by that, has Trump so locked us into this particular position that there's no graceful exit? And I think one of the things that's nice about Trump and his unconventional negotiation style, he is never ashamed of anything. And so if he wants to create an off-ramp, embarrassment will never hold him back. Remember the operative principle about Donald Trump. He wants to suck all the options, all the oxygen out of the room. He wants to be the center of attention. And to some extent, if you have stable and sensible properties, you're like Ed Sullivan standing on the stage where other people take the limelight. And he doesn't like to be out of the limelight. So for him, turmoil is essentially the first best solution to a personal ego problem, which seems to know no upper bound. And I think that's been the story of his presidency. I can think of no president who has been willing to command the stage like this, no matter how much turmoil and confusion that it starts to create. And, you know, I've said time after time, I wish he'd resign. But on the other hand, his popularity is now increasing. And if he actually pulls this thing off, it will increase further. The Democrats have to seriously worry if they're going to have a brand of socialism, which says that, you know, it turns out we have $25 an hour minimum wages, uniform health care, strong unions everywhere, and no productivity.
Right, as concise as ever.
We could become Venezuela if it turns out that we elect the right people.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column. It's called The Libertarian, and you can find it at definingideas@hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating The Libertarian Podcast on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.